You don't know what's going to happen. That's why gambling doesn't make any sense.
But that's why it does make sense, honey. Don't you see? If a person knew what was going to happen, there wouldn't be any point.
Why?
Why? Because it wouldn't be a gamble then.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the U.S. Racing Sports Gambling Show. I am your friendly host, Derek Simon, and this is the show where we talk about everything and anything related to the world of gambling. Now, before we get into the show, some great guests today. Ellis Starr, the Uber capper, is on the program, as well as our weekly visit from Kevin Rogers. But before we get to that, there are some things you need to know.
I'm looking forward to completing your training. In time, you will call me Master.
All righty then. I learn it from a book.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're gonna remember this the rest of your life.
Oh, I already knew that.
I don't get it.
What part didn't you understand?
Will you never learn?
Tell you I can't. Yes.
All right, well, the first thing you need to know today is that... I almost said something wildly inappropriate. Have you ever done that? You're talking, and suddenly something comes to your mind. You think about saying it, and then you think, whoa, where did that come from? So I'm not going to tell you something wildly inappropriate, but I do want you to check out usracing.com. That was a terrible segue, but who cares? Just go to usracing.com because you're going to find so much stuff there. And among the things you need to know are the point spreads for the football games this weekend. I'm not going to go through all the college point spreads, but I thought I would go through the NFL point spreads. Green Bay plays Detroit. Green Bay, a 3-point favorite. The 49ers and the Bears match up. The Bears are 7-point favorites. The Bears have actually been playing very, very well recently. Team to watch and look at and study. Cincinnati and Cleveland in the Battle of Ohio. I did want to talk a little bit about this game because it highlights the folly of small sample sizes. Size matters when it comes to samples. Cleveland is a 10-point underdog in this game. And I was doing some checking on the records that these teams have accumulated over the years. In the past 10 meetings, Cincinnati, 7-3 against the spread. Now, how many times do you hear sports bettors say, well, in the last 10, this team is 7-3. Now, these stats are since 2010. The first ridiculous thing about statements like that is because you're talking about completely different teams, especially in today's day and age with the salary cap. So that's number one. Number two is 10 games doesn't matter. If you go back to 2000, guess what? Cleveland is 15-14-1 against the spread. Not only do you notice that the team with the advantage switched from Cincinnati to Cleveland, but 15-14, who cares? So just something to look for when you hear about these crazy statistics that people love to throw out. I mean, they're fun. Don't get me wrong. It's fun to hear that stuff and, you know, mull it over, but I wouldn't spend a lot of time using it as a betting tool. Tennessee, 2.5-point favorites against the Jacksonville Jaguars. The Buffalo Bills. I can't figure out the Bills. They look great at times. Other times they look terrible. They are 3-point favorites against the Houston Texans. Houston been playing a lot better recently. Miami is a 4-point favorite against Baltimore. The Carolina Panthers. How about this team? And I'll tell you something. I'm a Seattle fan and a Denver fan. I was born in Seattle, hence my Seattle allegiance, and I live in Denver. And I kept waiting for Carolina to take that next step, like Seattle had, and now apparently Seattle has taken the next step down. But Carolina, I think, finally has taken that next step forward. You know, I still think they're beatable, but boy, they are an impressive team, -7 against the Saints. Speaking of the Seattle Seahawks, they're in a pick'em with the Minnesota Vikings. Minnesota playing very well this year. Arizona and St. Louis. Arizona a 6-point favorite. The Tampa Bay... speaking of inappropriate. Almost lost it there with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They are 2-point favorites against the Atlanta Falcons, Falcons. The Jets are 2-point favorites against the Giants in the Battle of New York. Kansas City, a 3-point favorite against Oakland. That's kind of surprising to me. On the road in Oakland, Kansas City, a 3-point favorite. The Pittsburgh Steelers, a 7-point favorite against the Matt Hasselbeck-led Indianapolis Colts. And then last but not least, the Monday night game, Dallas and Washington. The Washington Redskins are 4.5-point favorites. Now, I've got a great interview tape with Ellis Starr. We'll get to that next, and then we'll wrap it up with Kevin Rogers of Vegas Insider. I'm now thrilled to be joined by Ellis Starr. Ellis is the Uber capper, and he's really the reason that I'm podcasting. Years ago, I think it was 1996 or something like that, a company named Trackmaster came out. I actually watched their presentation on a VHS tape. You young kids probably don't even know what I'm talking about, but Ellis was part of Trackmaster. He interviewed guys like Doc Sarton, Tom Brohammer, James Quinn, did a great job. Welcome to the program, Ellis.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that little flashback there. It was a lot of fun back then. I think technology's come a long way, so people can get a lot more information, but it is interesting. And just starting out back then when, you know, there weren't really PPs available on the internet, believe it or not. The form hadn't entered the market yet, and we were one of the first, and the ability to speak with some of those names, still big names in the industry, was a real pleasure, and glad that you enjoyed them.
Yeah, and, you know, Trackmaster was, to the best of my knowledge, the first that gave access to past performances relatively cheaply. And I remember when they first came out, I thought, this is the revolution in the game. How did you get started with Trackmaster? And for that matter, Ellis, just working online?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, first of all, they were the first, and it was, you know, during the first dot-com boom. They saw a market, never did anything in print. It was always electronic and thought it would be a good market. And I got started with them. Oh, wow. I can't remember. I think I just saw an ad in the racing forum, and I was working in a family business that my kind of inherited from my father, and, was looking at other options. It was about the time of right after the big earthquake in Southern California, the Northridge earthquake. And I was thinking what was out there, and I had, of course, been going to the race my whole life and had vast business knowledge as well, having run a company for a number of years, and decided I'd give it a shot, drove up there, interviewed with them, and started as a customer service manager. And, of course, they were doing everything at the time. They had the little handheld. The Internet was just moving to Windows-based stuff. Everything was a lot of DOS at that time. People remember floppy disks. So gave it a shot, and... that was just a lot of fun being in that environment, thinking that we could revolutionize racing. And, of course, because it was the first to provide any kind of electronic racing information, we did that.
When you did the interviews, obviously I didn't know much about your own personal approach, but I've learned since. And I love the way, you know, you go about handicapping, the idea of win contenders, because a lot of folks look at a race and forget about the fact that there are probabilities attached to every contender. Tell me a little bit about your value betting approach and how you've honed it over the years.
Well, I got to give all of the thanks in the world to my mentor, Dick Mitchell. You know, talk about the guys we interviewed, Quinn, Brohammer, Sarton as well. But Mitchell was really the first guy that was well-known, because Sarton was known in circles. Mitchell had been published, along with Quinn, was a good friend of Jim Quinn's, Modern Investing at the Racetrack, which is the first book that really talked about making a line. And the problem throughout history of racing was that people always bet the best horse and not the best bet. And it was known in circles, but it wasn't really known as, and now everybody talks about value overlay, etc. It was known in sports as well. So, meeting Dick before I went to work for Trackmaster, and just, you know, kind of getting some motivation from him and some of his skill set in terms of making a line, and just realizing that that was the key, not to making money, but to losing less. You have discipline, of course, you could make money. So I started doing that, and in the mid-90s, when Trackmaster branched out from just selling the data on the internet via the little HP 95, and again, via the web browsers and things that were available at the time, back to Netscape, we decided to go from also doing the data to actually selling selections. And we decided we would take a year of putting out selections a couple races a day based on the Trackmaster data. I mean, at the time, the thought was to use it as a way to tell people how good the data was, because we could talk about the speed figures and the statistics, which, you know, nobody else had really done at that point unless people were doing it themselves. So I started to, I took over that division, started the division called the Selection Division, the Winner Circle Selections at the time it was called, and, you know, had a couple other people that I thought were good handicappers, and we did a couple races a day. Through that, just through the methodology of my own handicapping growing up and learning what I learned from Dick, it was pretty simple, basic handicapping, Derek. I mean, you'd eliminate the non-contenders and put the rest in order. I didn't make 100% odds line. And it was very subjective because, you know, as you know, the basis of an odds line is to give you a guideline for when a horse is a good bet or not. Going back to what Mitchell taught, which was don't bet the best horse, bet the best bet, whether that's the second or third best horse in a race, and let the value hopefully make up for the fact that you're not that good at making an odds line, which nobody really is.
Ellis, I know you make your odds line a little bit different than some. I want to talk about that in a second. But I'd also like you to advise players who want to make an odds line as to some of the pitfalls. I know for me, the first piece of advice I would give folks is that when you make an odds line, I think the natural inclination initially is to not have the ratings be separated enough. And so, and I think Dick Mitchell actually talked about this. So in other words, you have a 10 horse field and you find that your favorite is 3-1 and the longest horse is 10-1. That's not the way the betting works. And I know some people have gotten around it by looking at the top three and assigning them 75% of the probabilities or whatever. But if I'm correct, I don't think you actually use a percentage line per se. You just come up with some odds that you think are reasonable. Tell me a little bit about how you make a fair odds line and what you think that beginning players, players who want to make an odds line, need to know.
Well, let me answer the second question first. Dick was very clear on that, and I do a lot of education. That's my love, besides doing the picks every day for Trackmaster and Equibase and their distributed places and doing our race of the week and some blogs and things. And my love is fan education, so I work with a lot of groups, mostly at Kentucky Tracks, but I do go to Preakness and Belmont and Breeders' Cup and work with groups of fans of all levels every racing day at those tracks. And one of the things I tell people who are interested in that and look at that and want to know what fair odds is, because I'll tell you, a majority of people don't know what fair odds, which is the word I actually use what it means, but I tell them it's a guideline and they get it right away, is Dick said this, and again, this goes back to handicapping. So let's say, no matter what the field size is, but I'd say in a field of 10, you get it down to 4 or 5, the field of 8, you get it down to 3 or 4 contenders, you draw a line, you just take shots and eliminate horses that you think you don't have to have a certain probability, you just think they don't have enough probability to win. And if you get, for the beginner, if you get down to 4 horses, make them all 4-1. If you get down to 3 horses, make them all 3-1. You end up at 75 to 80% at that point. And then, you know, you can get beaten by the other 6, 7, 8 horses in a race, but that's okay, because if you're getting an edge on those odds, you do it. Now, you know, after you make an initial line, let's say 4 horses, 4-1, you can go back and look and say, I really feel horse A is stronger than horse B, so he should be 3-1 in my mind, because not only do I want to bet him, which is not exactly correct, but I think that the public is going to see some value in him. So he'll be a little lower, so I want to make sure that I get a fair shot at betting him. So that's the basic rule for people, I think, that are just starting out. Don't really worry about percentages and probabilities. If it's 2 horses, make them 2-1. If it's 3, make them 3-1. If it's 4, make it 4-1. If you have a 12 or 14 horse field, make 5 horses, make them 5-1. And then you can mess with it. Now, personally, I think for the early years, the first 10 years since I've been doing public handicapping, basically, even though most of it is for cost, but some is free, for almost 20 years next year, I think I don't do it anymore, but I used to look at the line afterwards, add it up and see it added up to 75 or 80%. But now I just kind of gauge it. I mean, I know at the end, if I have 5 horses and I'm way over 100, I'll change one. But I think for the most part, it doesn't matter anymore. So, you know, if I'm looking at a race and I have 4 horses and I make, you know, 5-2, 5-2, 7-2, 7-2. And, you know, I'm probably going fast. I know you get it. A lot of people get that. You got 28, 28, 22, and 22. That equals 100. Okay, maybe I shouldn't make 100%, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's all relative, because I'm not concerned about whether the 5-2 is going to be 3-1. I don't go back and look at how often my horses were the odds they were, which is what Barry Meadow and other people suggest. And I don't object to people doing that. I just think it takes a lot of time. It doesn't make your odds line stronger. My methodology stays the same. So I always end up, for the most part, at 70-90%.
Let me ask you this, and I, you know, I apologize if we're kind of hammering this point, but I think it's really, really important, and it's something I've wanted to talk to you about for a long time. When you have your fair odds, how strict are you? You know, a lot of folks have tried conditional wagering and come away disenchanted because it is difficult to work. Now, I've found some methods that I think do work for conditional wagering, but how much of a stickler are you? Let's say you've got a horse that you think is 7-5 and is going off 6-5. Do you still make the bet? Where do you make those cutoffs?
Well, I'm still learning that one. that's betting is so much harder than handicapping, and I think most people know when to make those cutoffs. I think as a general rule, certainly the obvious ones are obvious. You make a horse 2-1, it's 6-1. It's a nuanced thing. So if I have three horses at 3-1, for example, and, you know, the third one is 8-1, you got to pull the trigger. And it's nuanced. You know, don't forget you have other bets you can make. I mean, you can always bet doubles. If you think that they're close enough and you don't want to bet them to win, you can bet doubles. But to be really honest, I don't give it much thought in terms of odds. If I do have a horse, again, until I make a horse less than 2-1, I'm pretty strong on it. Because I really don't do that much. I mean, occasionally even money, it's usually in a crappy race where I put a horse even money or 6-5 because I know I'm going to play the horse in big threes, which is that's my second best favorite besides twin betting. So we'll do that. As far as, you know, looking at the odds, if I have four horses in a race and they are different odds, I don't really consider that. Even though I made one 5-2 and one 7-2 and one 9-2, I will look at them in perspective to what they really are close to on the tote board. So if one's 10-1 and he was really 9-2, I'll bet him over the 2-1 going off at 5-2. Because in the end, it's making enough money to make up for the losses and getting the ROI to as close to zero as possible.
Let's talk a little bit about pick threes and pick fours. I had Tommy Massis on. Tommy, a very good contest player. And he likes the bet. And everybody who plays pick threes and pick fours, they make the same argument. If you look at the takeout, it's actually less because you're playing several races. As a value handicapper, I will tell you, Alice, you talked about how you're still learning. That's my worst ROI always, year in and year out, is on pick threes and pick fours because I don't assess value. I don't assess what the crowd is going to do very well. I know what my fair odds are, but I don't know how the crowd is going to bet. How, as a value guy, do you get around that? Do you have any tips as to when you should play a pick three? Maybe some tips so that I don't hit the all button every time a favorite wins. And I don't do it very often, but when I do, a favorite always wins. Any suggestions for folks as to how they can play some of the horizontal wagers?
Well, again, this is about cutting down negative ROI and increasing positive ROI. So one thing you don't do is you don't start with a favorite. If you like a horse to win in a race and he's even money, 6-5, 7-5, anything under than about 2-1, I'd say just don't play the pick three. If you have any doubt, then that's the all. But you don't start with a favorite because everybody's doing that. You want to catch the second and third legs. I play a lot of alls, and again, I rely on my odds line in total. So, you know, for the sake of discussion, I don't have my spreadsheet in front of me, but if my winner's in the top three 60% of the time or 65% of the time, whatever it is, then I'll just use all three and play 3x3x3, 3x4x3. However, when I do look at the morning line and I do see a horse that's 6-8-1, it's one of my top two picks, I'll then go back and play tickets with singles. And one of my favorite plays that's a cheap play, and you can get very lucky, is single, three tickets, which is single, all, single, all, single, single, and single, single, all. And so you're playing your top pick in the three. If one of the top picks win, two of the top picks win, you win. If three of them win, you win the bet three times. You do that. That's a very inexpensive option. It may sound like a lot, but at the most it's, you know, $8 or $9 times three times. That's a play to do it, and then you're trying to maximize profit. You're going to have a lot of runouts. Your percentage of winning victories is going to go down. The other thing to do is just to play the mud on the wall theory, which is if you have three picks in a race and they're relatively close in your assessment of contenders, don't worry about it. Just play 3x3x3 and hope that the second and third choices win two of the three legs, and then you're really rewarded in those races. But for me, it's I don't have any strong methodology of ways I play the pick three except for the single all, using singles and three legs and playing it. I love doing that, especially when the middle leg is a leg I actually hate, a maiden claimer or something. I'm just hoping some 20-to-1 shot gets up.
Very good. Well, Ellis, tell folks how they can get a hold of you and get a hold of your work.
Well, I've got a lot of things on the bill right now. Of course, every Friday or Thursday, Friday, there's feature race at equibase.com, which is our race of the week. Also includes a lot of free products. But right now, it's always almost always a great one. This coming up once in a while, it's like a claiming crown or something like that. And then that's also on America's Best Racing, which is a great website for newer fans. I do weekend six preview show every Friday night, 6 to 7 Eastern time on horseracingradio.net, which is also on Sirius. You get information there. You know, I write some blogs. You can punch Google. The picks themselves are everywhere. They're on Equibase, Trackmaster, most of the major ADWs, and it's normal in Southern California every day with an additional track on Saturday, whatever the biggest race is being run. And then I do the entire Kingwell meet, and I do try and do the entire Derby week, of course, all the Triple Crown and Breeders' Cup. It adds up to about 300 race cards a year for as far as full card selections. You can always get them for free, by the way, in case anyone's never seen my stuff. Just go to Equibase or Trackmaster at 12:01 midnight. Everything that was for pay goes for free for all the selections. We've done that. That was one of the things I put in place 20 years ago when we started the division, which is if we had a good day, you could see it. If you had a bad day, it's there. And that way people can judge based on the analysis and some of the methodology, not only if the horses did well or not, but more about what I say about a race and give that. I think I do add value, as you said, and I appreciate that. I still to this day write a paragraph or two for every race talking about what went into my selection so people can get some handicapping tips at the same time.
That's a good point, and I should have brought it up because you do a great job in your write-ups. Thank you so much, Ellis. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Derek, it was a great talking to you, and I wish everybody a lot of luck, and just keep trying to make those simple lines and bet the best bet.
Now, here's why you can win.
Every time you lose, you die a little bit. You die inside, a portion of you. Not all of your organs, maybe just your liver.
In our business, there is no second place. Either you're first or you're last.
You sick, salty. I mean, you walk in that door on your two legs, all fat and cocky.
You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward.
See that? That's your IQ, buddy. Zero.
If you look at this play, what we're trying to get is a seal here and a seal here and try to run this play in the alley.
Remember, we do everything in reps. So if you have 2 reps of water drinking, usually we do 10 reps of everything. So do another rep of water drinking.
Well, I am joined now, as I am every week, by Kevin Rogers of VegasInsider.com. Since Kevin started on this program, 7-2. And I don't want to sound like one of those bombastic shows where, you know, we're guaranteeing this and throwing out a gazillion stars and so forth, but a great performance. Before we get to all of the football action this week, Kevin, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was very good. It was very good. Thankfully, I stayed away from some of the football games on Thursday, but no, things worked out very well. It was a successful weekend. Unfortunately, now college football is coming to a close, at least the regular season. I mean, you got all these bowl games coming up. But, no, it's a very fun time of year with a lot of basketball. Very busy with the NBA and college basketball. So obviously it's, one door closes, the next one opens, and, it's been pretty good so far.
Hey, Kevin, I've got to ask you this. Since I live in Colorado, I was watching that Sunday night football game with New England and Denver. Thought it was a great game. But then in the aftermath, I heard all this stuff about referees. Is it as much of a problem as some people seem to think? I don't know. Sometimes I think it's social media and the ability now to dissect plays. You know, you can see a bobble where if it's to the naked eye, you don't see it at all. I've heard some people say that the refereeing in the NFL is the worst of all the major sports. Do you take that tact? Is the refereeing in the NFL really that bad?
I do, and to your point, yes, we can replay everything. We could throw it on Twitter and Facebook immediately and put the meme or the Vine or whatever you want to call it up there. People can see it, but You know, also, I think the problem is, Derek, it's almost rule interpretations. I think that's the problem. It's not about judgment calls where you say, wow, his foot was in bounds or he was down and you messed that one up. I think it's more about rule interpretations. I mean, you go back to that Lions-Seahawks Monday night game when the ball got batted out of the end zone and it clearly was batted out and should have been first down for the Lions. They called it a touchback. That's a rule interpretation. You have to get that one right. And, you know, you look at the Danny Amendola catch against the Buffalo Bills when they blew the whistle dead, and you're kind of like, you know, you say to yourself, like, what are these guys doing? I think that's more where it stems from as opposed to bad judgment calls, because everyone's going to make a bad judgment call, and maybe replay can bail you out. But when you're messing up rule interpretations, you have inadvertent whistles, it's kind of like, you know, this is supposed to be the top level of officiating, and it's made the NFL really look bad this year.
You know what I think one of the big problems is, honestly, is that there are just too many rules. But enough of my griping. Go ahead.
Derek, let me just add on to that really quick. That the other problem, too, is we don't know the rules.
Right.
You say you have all these rules. We don't know the rules. Like, you know, it goes back to the catch thing that, you know, this week this is a catch. Last week this is a catch. And you're saying, well, we don't understand the rules. We're watching the game. We don't know what's what. So it's not even about so many rules. It's inconsistencies with the rules. And you say, I don't know what I'm watching anymore because I'm not sure how long you have to hold on to the ball for it to be a catch. You have to take it back to the sidelines to prove that you had possession of it. And it's just, that's the other problem, is that no one's explaining it. And we're all watching this saying, we don't really know what's going on because we don't know what anything is anymore.
Well, I agree with that 100%. I actually think that's at the heart of everything, because especially with the catch, you brought up a great example. Boy, it is tough to know what a catch is anymore. That being said, it's supposed to be Thanksgiving or post-Thanksgiving, and I'm griping here about officiating. Let's go on and talk a little bit about some more fun things. You've got some bowl game, or not bowl games to look at, but some conference champions to look at, championships to look at, and also some NFL games.
I'm going to focus on a couple of the conference championship games. One of them, the Pac-12 title game in Santa Clara between Stanford and USC. This is the second time these two teams are playing this season. The first time USC played Stanford at the Coliseum, USC was up by 11 points early. Stanford came back as a 9.5-point dog. They ended up winning the game outright. Really good win for the Cardinal. But that was when Steve Sarkisian was the coach of the Trojans. And early on in the season, they had their issues. He had his own personal issues, and he was shown the door. Now Clay Helton, who was the interim coach, now has the interim tag removed by Pat Hayden, and this is the guy moving forward for them. They played well. They beat UCLA last week at home. They've looked very good down the stretch. There's a lot more confidence there, and they still have the Rose Bowl to play for. That if they can win this game against Stanford, that they can get into the Rose Bowl and kind of salvage this season. And now you're flipped from a 9.5-point favorite to a 4.5-point underdog. It is a neutral site. You could probably say it's more of a home game for Stanford being played in the Bay Area. But, you know, for Stanford coming off an emotional win over Notre Dame last week, again, they probably shouldn't have won if they got that last second field goal. I think USC has the confidence that they know they can hang with Stanford. And now getting some points, I think, is a good play looking at USC. Another conference championship, Derek, I want to look at is the ACC between North Carolina and Clemson. That the Clemson Tigers, they've pretty much been coasting for the last month and a half or so, just trying to get to this championship game, and then they know they'll be in the top four with them being ranked number one. North Carolina comes in. They lost their opener to South Carolina on a neutral site in Charlotte. Now they're actually back in Charlotte again for this ACC championship. But they've been on fire. They've won 11 in a row. They haven't lost an ACC game yet. Now, granted, they didn't play FSU, and they didn't play Clemson. So just to put that out there. But Carolina is in the underdog role. They have an explosive offense. And for Clemson, I kind of feel like this team is like Weiss, the finish line. That, with the exception of beating FSU, where they had to come back from a halftime deficit, in this stretch, they've beaten Boston College, Wake Forest. They just beat South Carolina last week, a week after South Carolina lost to the Citadel. So Clemson's beat up on a lot of teams that they should be beating, and a lot of teams aren't going to bowls. And now they're really stepping up in class, taking on this North Carolina team that will probably fall short of the top four simply because they're 10th right now and they need too many things to happen. But for North Carolina, they've just been on fire, and I think the momentum is more on their side. I'll take the points with them against Clemson.
Very good. And you also mentioned you have an NFL game to look at.
Yes. One of the ways I handicap, Derek, is I like looking at teams that people just give up on, that they absolutely give up on them, and then you pounce on them when the odds makers are just giving them a ton of points just because everyone thinks they're dead in the water. And the team I'm looking at this week that fits that criteria is the Philadelphia Eagles, that they go to New England to take on the Patriots. And, you know, we talked about New England's loss to Denver last Sunday night, that they were up 21-7, they lose in overtime. But also they lose Rob Gronkowski to a knee injury. He's going to be out on Sunday. This team is just decimated by injuries on the offensive side. And we know how good New England is, regardless, with Belichick and with Brady. And defensively, they played well. But for Philadelphia, they've lost three in a row. They've looked bad. They were humiliated on Thanksgiving at Detroit. And now they're supposed to get Sam Bradford back on Sunday after Mark Sanchez played last week. And all of a sudden now you're getting double digits with an Eagles team that was thought to maybe win the NFC East this year. And you know something, with this NFC East being as wide open as it is, where we could probably throw the Cowboys out of the mix with Romo being out, but the Giants and the Redskins are at the top and really haven't made a convincing argument to win the division. If the Eagles can somewhat catch fire here at the end, maybe they can get in at 7-9 and get in the playoffs, or 8-8. So it's not totally out of the realm of possibility. And you look at them getting this amount of points against New England, who suffered its first loss of the season last week, and now they're down probably their best offensive weapon besides Tom Brady. That's a lot of points to lay. That I'll look at the Eagles. They had a couple extra days to prep and to get Bradford ready. I'm going to take the points with Philadelphia.
I got to tell you, Kevin, regardless of how the game finishes, I like that kind of analysis, because I think that is the way you profit in sports betting. Everybody's going to be looking one way on this, and I agree with you. People are thinking, oh, I guarantee you're going to hear, oh, New England, they're hungry. After that loss, they're mad. Brady's mad. Yeah, yeah, okay, but, you know, you're not going to make money that way, because everybody thinks that way. So I really like these picks. So just to kind of recap, and I got this from U.S. Racing, +4.5 on USC, +4.5 on North Carolina, and to close out the long shot trifecta, +10 on Philadelphia. Thanks as always, Kevin. Look forward to chatting with you next week.
All right, Derek, thank you.
Now, back to your host. While he's still sober, here's Derek.
I want to thank my guest this week, Ellis Starr, the Uber capper. You can find Ellis's work at Equibase.com, among other places on the World Wide Web. Also, Kevin Rogers of VegasInsider.com. Remember to go to VegasInsider.com for all of your sports betting data needs. And, of course, U.S. Racing, where you can find lines on the NFL, the NCAA, anything you need is at U.S. Racing, where they are truly setting the pace. And, of course, I want to thank all of you. Hope you have a great wagering week. Talk to you again next week.